Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to be speaking with Sarah Rotherham. She is one of the most respected voices in luxury fragrance and brand development, and she spent her career really breathing new life into heritage fragrance brands, whilst never losing sight of what made them special in the first place. And what I find particularly fascinating about her approach is how she combines that creative intuition with that commercial savviness, which is something that's easier said than done in an industry where passion and spreadsheets don't always speak the same language. So in today's conversation, Sarah shares some wonderful, honest insights about leadership, creativity. Plus, she tells us about one of the most ingenious marketing campaigns. It involves gin, Michelin-starred chefs, and a car park in Fitzrovia that I attended as a young beauty journalist back in the day. So settle in, it's a really great conversation about not just building brands, but also staying creatively inspired in a rapidly changing industry. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Now, you've worked across heritage and contemporary brands. What's your first instinct when you step into a business that sort of needs reinvigorating?
Really, a pathway to fall in love with a brand, I suppose, because you often enter into a brand with preconceptions around what it is, or you're looking at it from the outside. And my instinct really is just to dig. So with the heritage brands, you know, on all the heritage brands I've worked with, both sort of Penhaligon's and then later Creed, one of the first things I did was bring in an archivist that worked for 6 months, just pulling the archive together. And it's always fascinating because you learn so much about the history of the brand. But then my next route is usually, well, being on the sales floor, talking to customers. And actually, Creed was very interesting because I joined Creed second week of lockdown. And I was like, wow, how am I going to do this? Because naturally, I would go to the sales floor, sell the product, feel the product. And I'm kind of locked in my home. But actually, it turned out to be quite a fascinating journey, because what I did instead was reached out to all these people that work for the brand around the world and said, are you up for Zoom calls? And I think I interviewed like maybe 500 staff globally.
Wow.
From my house, asking them, you know, who's the customer? What do they like? Why do they buy it? Why are they in love with it? Why do you love it? And honestly, it was like the best market research ever. So my instinct usually is, like, before we write the strategy, just dig and understand the brand, because otherwise you come in really as a consumer. And that's great, but you kind of need to test your views and your instinct on the brand with the people that are selling it and the customers that are buying it.
Yeah, because the best people that know your customer are the ones on the shop floor, like on the front line, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and often you go into these brands and people have worked for the brand for so many years. And they can give you such an insight on, you know, why they see the repeat customers, the kind of conversations they have, why they love it. You know, honestly, I think it's always an undervalued resource.
100%.
Speaking to the people that are on the front line.
Definitely. And it emphasizes the importance of staff retention in those roles, because obviously the longer you are with the brand, the more you know about it, and the, you know, the more authority you have when you're talking to a customer about it.
Yeah, but also, you know, as a leader, I mean, it allows you to bring these invaluable team members on a journey with you, because you're engaging with them very early on and, you know, sort of demonstrating how valuable they are, because you're sort of bringing them into the process in the very early stages.
100%. And so at Penhaligon's and Miller Harris, you kind of managed to refresh the brands, but you didn't alienate the loyal customers. I think particularly so at Penhaligon's. And I really sort of loved what you did with that brand and sort of reinvigorating it, but still kind of tapping into its rich history. I mean, what's the secret to kind of modernizing a brand's heritage, but you kind of don't lose its soul in the process?
I think a big part of that is storytelling. And look, the purpose of really understanding the history of the brand is that you want to be relevant to today's consumer, but you always kind of want to have this one foot in the past. So I think that, I think one of the other really important things, and I learned this probably in the hard way early in my career, is that sometimes you can go too fast and then you lose your customers. So, you're always excited about the thing that's coming next and you're planning 2, 3, 5 years ahead. But sometimes it's actually just better to slow down and take a customer on that journey with you. Like even things like packaging, like small tweaks to the packaging to get to where you want to get to, rather than just a huge leap forward. Like for example, again, going into Creed, it's like we had multiple brand logos and we decided that there was one that we wanted to get to, which just was a refinement of what had come before. But we had like a vision of where we wanted it to be, but we did small steps to get there. And often that means you take the customers with you whilst allowing you to recruit and bring new customers into the brand. Similarly, it's not just packaging, it's that storytelling, sort of taking the existing story, but just refining the language around how you talk about it to ensure that it's modern and it's relevant. And I think, telling those stories in a way that feels fresh to the customer, albeit you're not changing the past, but what you are doing is presenting it in a way that meets their lifestyle today. So that could be animation through marketing. It could be the tone of voice in which you do your campaigns. But it's really thinking about how do you keep the customers and all the bits. Having done that research in the very beginning, how do you keep hold of those things, but then make sure it's really relevant? And a lot of that is tone of voice and how you show up and where you show up. There's another thing, little thing that I do, which is I tend to do it with my team, like a who are we and who are we not? So we list who we are in terms of personality, to where we show up, to how we behave, and who are we definitely not. And it's a really useful exercise to keep you focused on what's relevant to the brand, because lots of things are happening around you. And you're like, that's great. We could do that and we could do that differently or bigger. And then you have to pull back and go, but does it sit within our who we
Yes,
are and who we are not?
for sure.
Because you can get really excited about lots of different ways that you can tell a story, but it has to feel like you. And similarly with things like collaborations, great collaborations often sort of come your way. And I can think in Penhaligon's in particular, there were things that are like, oh my God, it's so fabulous. But it doesn't fit. We had to say no because it just didn't fit into our sense of modern Britishness, so that it's a really simple exercise, and quite often you do it with guts with people around the table, and it gives you a really clear steer on like where the brand sits and who you are.
And obviously, with what I do at Spot, it involves a lot of storytelling, and it can sometimes it's a tricky balance that I've sort of honed over the years of being kind of creative and artistic, and I know you are as well in your approach, but also keeping that commercial hat on. I mean, how do you navigate those kind of two opposing sides of it?
I mean, it depends on if you're talking about product launches or if you're talking about other ideas. I think when it comes down to product, yes, you have to try and take a commercial view and you need to understand the landscape. So you need to understand what your effective portfolio is versus the trends. You need to be mindful of all of that. But at the same time, you're always looking to tip the it's tipping point. You're always looking to tip the needle. So sometimes you have to let creativity and gut lead the way because, customers don't necessarily always know what they want next. So market data and research and everything is brilliant, but at the same time, there needs to be a lot of gut in, is it a great product? Is it addictive? Do I keep coming back to it? How many people are stopping me when I'm wearing this sample? And you have to allow that to lead. And again, very interesting. I remember being in one role. And of course, I typically work in a world where there's lots of private equity and they like numbers and they like data. And all data's super relevant, by the way. But they'll go, well, where's the data to prove that this is going to be a success? And I remember freaking them out, talking about love and passion and gut. And they're looking at me like I'm crazy. But the best creative projects and the best commercial successes are when it's come from that place of creativity and gut when it comes to product. Of course, you need to be commercial in how do we roll it out? How do we test it to make sure that it doesn't cost us a fortune if it's not a success? And You know, you need to be commercial in your approach to your route to market. And you also need to be commercial in your approach of, okay, let's look at the data that's telling us, you know, what our customers open and, you know, where we get engagement on posts and, you know, what's the things that are resonating with our consumer. But when it comes to actually product, I think you have to lead with creativity. Otherwise, you're going to end up just feeling like everybody else. So I think it's a truly is a balance, but I think you know me a little bit. You know, there's nothing worse than someone coming in with pages and pages of PowerPoint of data, because then you're just drowning the whole world in data. And there's an awful lot to be said for instinct when it comes to product.
100%. And I think industry trends and things like customer profiles are all well and good, and it's good to have that in the mix, but I'm sure you'll agree, kind of slavishly following them and gearing everything around that is just, people are going to sense it. They're going to sniff out that it's not terribly authentic. It's more just, paint
Yeah,
by
and I think that comes to the point of, are you selling it to them, or are you building a community and a world that people want to be part of? And that's the fine line. You know, true success comes from, you've got a great product, you've got this community, and you're focused on that community, and you're focused on the customer experience, and that delivers sales, as opposed to flipping it the other way. Consumers feeling like you're chasing the sales and you're just selling them something. I mean, you can't just market to customers anymore. You know, they want more. They want to be part of that cultural conversation. And where do you sit? So, you know, it's a balance, and I think it's a balance you kind of learn. And I think the less fear you have, the more able you are to deliver that balance.
There's a lot of talk about disruption and brands should be disruptive. I mean, what does that mean to you in the context of like luxury, fragrance, and beauty?
Being disruptive really comes from a place of bravery and a sense of passion around the fact that you're doing the right thing. And that could be around a product, but you know, I think I've done some quite disruptive things in my time. Actually, I think it's interesting. Cash flow also drives you to be disruptive. You know, when you don't have a lot to spend and you need to make sure your marketing spend goes really far, you don't do all the things that are expected of you, because they're hugely expensive. So you don't advertise, you don't do all the gift repurchases and all the sampling and all the things that are kind of expected of you. You have to find another way to reach your audience and to resonate super effectively. Like, so again, back in the day with Penhaligon's, when we launched a fragrance called Juniper Sling, I had zero marketing budget to launch that fragrance. And that fragrance came about because it was very British gin. Chatting to an old man in a bar one night, and I ordered a gin and tonic. He didn't know what I did, and he ordered six different gins. And he said, "Don't drink them, I want you to smell them." And I was like, "Wow, he doesn't even know what I do." Anyway, and they all smell amazing, these incredible botanicals. It was just at the start of the gin craze, you know, when gins and speakeasies started popping up. And I remember going into my team the next morning, I was like, "Okay, let's research London Dry Gin. I want to know everything about how gin is made." And we worked with Olivier Cresp on that fragrance. And at the time, he didn't do niche. He just did it for us because he thought the project was fun. But actually, I was in his lab and he was explaining to me that the fragrance was so good, you could drink it, right? You had seven CO2 extractions in there. You know, some of the ingredients that were in the fragrance were edible. And I was like, what do you actually mean? So anyway, to cut a long story short, I think we were one of the first to properly do fragrances and cocktails and scented dinners, but we did them quite differently than how they sort of morph today. We actually took the fragrances to the mixologist. We had safety data sheets. Some of the ingredients had to go to like minus 40 degrees or something to be safe to consume. And we actually used the same ingredients. So we took them from the fragrance houses to do the event and to do the food. And we did a pop-up speakeasy in a car park in
Oh, that's
Fitzrovia.
where I met you. That's what I attended it as
Yeah,
a young sort of beauty journalist, and that was kind
it was
of
so much fun.
brilliant.
And you
Absolutely.
know, we even had to decorate the toilets, because can you imagine the toilets in
I
a
remember in the
car park where we
bathtubs
did
of gin, it was just like brilliant.
bathtubs of gin, and we had sort of seven Michelin star chefs cooking on the roof of a car park, but we couldn't afford it. So what we decided to do was to open it up to our customers to buy tickets. And again, it was just at the start of like pop-up restaurants. And we sold out in a day. So I was like, put another day. So we managed to do 3 or 4 days of paid for
Promotion. That's fantastic.
promotion, and it funded our press event and our press event globally. And it was like, wow, this is magic. And we never would have got there. And our customers felt totally engaged because they were having the same experience as the press were having, albeit that they were obviously buying tickets. You know, they got to have like an amazing event, actually taste the notes. And how good a message is that, telling your customers that your fragrance is so good? It's got such high levels of naturals that you're actually eating some of them. And do you remember we actually sprayed the juniper on the on directly on the from a perfume bottle, obviously with no perfume in it, onto the fish. So I mean, you would never get there if you had large budgets, right? It kind of drives you to be more creative. It's somewhat disruptive, right? No one had really done that before. And it was like a tipping point for the brand as well. I mean, the sales off that fragrance just took the brand to the next level. So I think disruption comes often from a place of when you're driven to be super creative because you want to make sure that marketing spend, because otherwise you run out of ideas, let's be honest.
Yeah, and I just love the kind of the collaborations that you've done with the brands that you've worked on over the years. Do you think collaborations are important just to keep a brand dynamic in that sense?
Well, coming back to that point about cultural conversation and being culturally relevant to your customer, absolutely. But I believe they have to come from an organic point of a meeting of minds. If you're just doing collaborations because you want to reach that audience, is that audience where your customer already sits, or is there a reason why you want to reach a different audience? How much relevancy do you bring to both brands? And the best collaborations, honestly, are where organically you decide how that collaboration can happen. If you're approaching collaborations where it's all driven by the commerciality rather than creativity, again, I don't feel like they have so much resonance with the customer. So, I mean, I love collaborations because it allows you again to push the boundaries in terms of creativity. But I do think they have to come from a place of authenticity.
Have you ever been tempted to start a brand of your own with yourself as the figurehead?
Well, yes, I have. And I'm kind of contemplating that right now because obviously I'm between jobs. But it comes again back to I've got a couple of really good ideas, but I need to test them because you can't just do what's gone before just because I know how to make fabulous perfumes and how to run a business. You know, to launch a new brand, what's my point of difference? Is it strong enough? And the marketplace is so crowded. I mean, there's so many brands launching all the time. And then on top of that, all these great brands are launching many, many, many new perfumes. It's got to have a really, really strong story, and it's got to have a very strong point of difference. Otherwise, it's just an ego trip. Honestly, and I'm not really big on ego trips. So yes, I've considered it, and at the moment, I'm not sh honestly not sure if it's the right thing to do, or to take a brand because I quite like doing this because I've done it many times before, but take a brand that either has a great provenance, great products, or a fabulous story, and just accelerate that growth. It's got to have something magical about it to make your fingers tingle. So I'm not sure that I will launch a brand in the perfume industry too soon.
And how do you kind of, because obviously you've sort of spearheaded a lot of kind of huge sort of perfume brands like Creed. I mean, how do you keep that creativity and avoid, you know, without sort of feeling sort of burnt out roles?
There's a couple of tricks that I think I've learned along the way, by the way, and this just comes a little bit with experience. So sometimes you can throw too many balls in the air, you know, particularly when you're working at pace, and everything I've done in all my roles is at pace. So when I feel that it's crowding my thought and my judgment, I literally will take a step back. I will cancel stuff out of my diary. I will do nothing for a few days and just step back and go, how am I going to reapproach this? Because I still need to achieve all these things, but I don't have the mind space to do the things that's really driving the value if I'm stuck in operational everyday things. So I will literally say, I'm stepping back. I like to walk, right? I walk on most Sundays, 10 to 20K. Being outside in the big skies allows me to think and process.
Yeah.
But similarly, like sometimes I'll just call a day and I'll go to the V&A with my CMO or go and see an exhibition. And you just do something that's nothing to do with work that
Love a
helps you
field trip.
think creatively. Sorry?
I love a field trip. It's always.
Yeah, but it's, you know, all I just tell my whole team, go play ping pong, go play rounders, like, you
Yeah.
know. But you have to be able to step back because sometimes when the pressure is there and you're super busy, you just start drowning in every day, rather than thinking strategically or creatively around what's to come. Also, you know, again, I'm a huge believer in a lot of these things come organically. So, like, I'll have perfumers to my house for dinner, we hang out. We do fun stuff, not just work stuff. The more you know your perfumers as friends, and the more you engage on a personal level, it's so much easier just to build that magic. And that's really important. In the beginning, you have to kind of craft it because you have to find time to do these things. But I would say the key to creativity is it comes from everywhere, but you've got to have time. You know,
Yeah.
reading, that's the other thing that happens. So, you know, when you're really busy, you're cramming in, you're reading industry news and you're reading the news at night, and there's not time to get lost in books.
Yeah.
And for me personally, getting absolutely lost in a book fuels my creativity because my brain's not being crowded with all the thousands of messages that we're bombarded with from social media to news stories to industry news. And I always notice that when I'm not been reading, and I'm quite an avid reader, my creativity shrinks, my vocabulary shrinks, my thought process shrinks. So, and it doesn't work for everyone, but for me, getting lost in books is also really important. But it could be the thing that you love. If it's not books, it could be something else that just allows your mind to shut off. And then also really important for me is just to play. You know, I'm not very good at sitting down, so I recently got into, you know, doing dyeing from natural dyeing from flowers. So I'm in the garden making a mess like a little witch with her cauldron. And that sense of just playing and touching allows you to be organic, which again feeds the creativity.
And we're almost at the end of our time, but finally, I'd like to ask, I think when you kind of grow in your career or you grow a business, I think you can't help but kind of grow personally as well. So what were the sort of biggest kind of personal kind of life lessons that you learned about yourself along the course of your career?
I'll tell you one of my very early mistakes when I was the first a CEO. I was 32. And I think every time you get promoted, and I would be sort of astounded if this wasn't the case for most people and admire those that it isn't, you get a little bit of imposter syndrome every time you get promoted. Can I actually do this? And you have to take it. Like you have to learn that confidence, which you don't innately have when you're younger.
No.
So it makes you very fearful of making mistakes, right? Because you've just got to the next stage. Fear is your worst enemy when you're building your career. Honestly, mistakes are invaluable life lessons. The other mistake I made very early doors was throwing too many balls in the air.
Yeah.
Then you just don't know what's working and how to measure it or how to keep everybody moving in the right direction. So I think that's something you learn over time is like, what is the right time to throw that next ball? And how do you keep your team? Because everyone has huge to-do lists. How do you keep them focused on the thing that's really going to move the goalposts strategically when they've got a lot on their plate? What are the five things we have to deliver on that makes a success of the brand? And you learn how to communicate that, and unfortunately, it comes with the experience. So on a personal level, I think the other thing I learned was just being me. Being me, who I am in work is who I am outside of work.
Yes.
You know, and again, when I first worked in the industry, I think I described them as like industry dragons. You know, they were like women that behaved like men in the, you know, they were
Yeah, and
harsh.
I think TV shows like The Apprentice kind of feed into that stereotype, don't they? This kind of alpha dog, like backstabby, that kind
It's
of.
just not real.
Right.
It is real in lots of businesses. It's culturally still there. But that doesn't, you don't have to behave
No,
like that.
exactly.
And I think, like, again, the moment I started to leapfrog in my career was one, having less fear about my success, well, more other than focusing on the things that I felt were right and were going to drive forward. But being able to be truly a woman in a workplace. And what I mean by that is I can be an absolute softie. I'm very hard and very firm on decision making, but I know my team, I know about their personal life. If they come in and they're having a really tough time at home, I'm not embarrassed to say I can get tears in my eyes because I can
Yeah.
truly feel for them. And that's all about just being who you are. Like, I can get super excited, I can get emotional, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that I think allows you to succeed because everyone notices that you're just human. And that then therefore the mistakes are just part of being a human. So I think that was one of my biggest lessons in terms of how to really move forward is the sense of bravery, getting over that imposter syndrome fear, because you all get it a little bit at different moments of your career, and you need have to lean into your internal confidence and then just be you, the best version of you, of course. Not necessarily the version of me that's first thing in the morning that my husband gets when I'm a bit hangry, but the best version of you. And then I think one other, if I could give a piece of advice, I think the other thing, if I was to look back on my career, and I think you'll understand this as a young mum, and again, I think it was a time and a place and an era, but I honestly regret having my son quite so late in life. I was 35. I wasn't that old, even though it said on the maternity thing, mature mother. I was like, great.
Thank you for that stuff.
But I was always so busy with my career and so focused on my career, loved every moment of my day. I felt like I didn't have time to have a child. And I knew I wanted a child one day in life, but it was never felt like the right time. And then when I had my son, I remember thinking, why did I not do this sooner? It's the most beautiful, precious thing that has ever happened to me in my life. And of course, it's challenging. You have to juggle career and being a mum. And again, I would defy anybody that says you can have it all because you do. You have to make choices along the way. Doesn't mean say you can't be a fabulous mum, but you do have to make some choices along the way. But honestly, it was the best thing I've ever done. And I see, and this is culturally driven by the workplace. Women are still frightened that if they have a child, it's going to disrupt their career. And their career path will slow down. And there's loads of stats that point to the fact that that is the case. But honestly, it should always come first. And it was the biggest piece of advice I would give to young women.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I
It's
had
the
my son
best thing.
at 37 and it did disrupt my career. It did, but I've pivoted and I think that's the key thing. It's like you just have to work around it and take a different approach. I mean, that's why I launched my agency just as, as a way of kind of just having an infrastructure that would work for me because so many workplaces, as you know, just don't have that infrastructure to support working parents and mothers in particular.
I was talking to a woman the other day. I thought it was very interesting because I'd never heard of it. But in the States, like Meta, for example, pays for young women to freeze their eggs. And my instinct initially was like, that's terrible. It's like telling them to put off having a baby.
Yeah.
And then the other side of me, when I processed it, was like, well, actually, no, it's quite genius because actually, a lot of us want to have kids later. And can't defy the body clock. So actually it's quite genius because you're not giving everything up. But anyway, I'm kind of digressing slightly. But if I was to give my younger self one piece of advice, it's like you can bounce back, you can pivot, you can still have a career and have a child, and not to be fearful of it, because it's the most magical thing in your life ever. And my son is now 16, and I still think that every day.
Beautiful note to end on. Sarah, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
But no, thank you for inviting me on.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.